The following program is pre-recorded. On this week's Jerry Pippin's UFO Show, we delve into ET abductions. Many say it's a religious experience, a journey into spirituality. Others are not so sure. Many say it's a journey into horrors beyond belief. What really is going on? We have a very interesting show. We hope you stay tuned. There are many opinions on abductions and what they're really like. Some seem to think that they are surreal. Others are convinced they're definitely extraterrestrial. And there are many, many shades of opinions in between. I have an email here from Ted Twilliger, who has had abduction experiences. And he writes to me, he says, let me read it. The place where abductees are taken could easily be considered a type of hell. Room full of people, with blood-curdling screams, and crying out for Jesus to save them. Bug-eyed grays, they do the torture. I don't think this has anything to do with medical examinations at all. People who claim this are really ignorant of the facts. These ETs have a stink and smell so bad that it comes back to the abductees with horror, as they remember. Reptoids seem to be forcing intercourse on men and women, as they remember in their morning experience, a terror that defies all words. They know it will happen over and over and over again. This, Jerry, is the reality of abductions. The words I have written you are really inadequate to describe the horror. I am actually disgusted by the use of the word contactee. These tortured abductees were not just contacted. I know a woman who was on a table being worked on and saw this take place. She wrote to me, she said, near me was a line of men and women, all standing. They were naked. They were emotionless as they walked forward, a step at a time. As each person stepped forward, they eventually became the person at the front of the line. A look of horror would sweep over their face when they looked down and saw the chute. Then, they were pushed down the chute, and they were gone. Disappeared. I don't know, Jerry, have you heard about the hundreds of shoes that were found in the Arizona desert outside Phoenix? Perhaps this is connected. When people try to put sugar on the abduction subject, they make me sick. It's one thing to attempt to describe it and quite another to experience it. It truly is far worse than your worst nightmare. And unlike many bad life experiences that happen only once, like going to your parents' funeral or having surgery, this is only done once in a lifetime. Abductions are worse than anything that we can dream up because it doesn't happen just once. It happens over and over and over, often within the same week. That's Ted Twilliger's idea of abductions. We're now going to feature Kim Carlson. Kim Carlson has had lots of abduction experiences, and actually, her abductions have involved communication and maybe even, as they say in spirituality, seeing the light. Listen closely as we talk to Kim Carlson. She even wrote a couple of books about it. One of them's an interesting book. It's just out now, currently, and it's a picture book, a coffee table book about abduction experiences, far different from what Ted wrote about. Kim, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
You're not in Channel Island. You're back in the Midwest right now where we caught you, instead of out in California. You know, I first became aware of you back in 95, I think, when you had that first book out.
You did? Oh, my gosh. I'm surprised. Yes, 95. Not very many people knew about that book. It didn't get a lot of promotion because I dropped out right after I wrote
it. Kim, you just can't state you dropped out and not tell me why. What happened? Why did you become disinterested, or was that the reason? Why did you drop out?
Well, I was involved in, you know, the phenomenon personally with contacts for a period of 7 or 8 years. And I kept all of my contacts in my diary, and I eventually turned my diary into my book, which was Beyond My Wildest Dreams.
Now, that book from 95, is it still available?
You know, it's still available on Amazon. I never hear from my publisher. I've never gotten a royalty check, but it's been out there for 50 years. Yeah, so it's still out there on Amazon.
Long as we're talking about books, talk about this one. This is a very interesting concept. Tell the name and how to get it and a little bit about it, if you don't mind, Kim.
Okay. Well, my new book is called The Art of Close Encounters, and I'm self-publishing this time. And it is a coffee table book. It's 350 pages. It's 150 personal accounts of close encounters. So every time you turn the page, the artwork is on the right and the story is on the left.
Tell me about the artwork. I mean, is it by you, the artwork?
No, it's not. If you know about my first book, Beyond My Wildest Dreams, it was illustrated. I had, because I'm a photographer and I'm visual, I'm an artist, I wanted my first book illustrated, and it was a hit for everybody who got to see it. You know, they liked the illustrations, and so I decided that my next book would be a compilation book that was similar to my first book, but it would be other people's encounters. So this book, I actually put out an invitation 15 years ago for people to send me their art and their stories, but 15 years ago was pre-computers, and it was snail mail, and the sophistication of art wasn't there like it is today with all of the computer programs. People can make images that are lifelike and stunning and colorful and amazing, as to where, you know, 15 years ago, unless you were an oil painter or, you know, a really talented illustrator, it was difficult to come up with an image. Nowadays, an average artist can use the technology and the software and be a brilliant artist. So I think it's a good thing that I waited 15 years to finish the book, because now the artwork is as compelling as the story.
Okay, then who did the artwork? I mean, the various people?
Every person who sent me a story had to send me a piece of art to go with it. Now, about 80% of the images were done by the people with the stories. I had, I believe, about out of the 150 images, I believe I ended up doing 20 for people who just couldn't draw and couldn't find anyone else. So I sat down one day and I finished them up myself. I'd never done anything like that because really I'm a photographer. I gave up illustration a long time ago. And so I just used my Photoshop skills, and I would cut and paste my images together, and I'd send it back to them and say, is this right? And they'd say yes or no until we got it right. But by and large, most of the art is by
Kim. Probably many of our listeners have seen your work. I mean, you've been in the media for a long time.
Oh, why? You know, I worked on Baywatch for 7 years. I worked in the movie in 20 years. Yeah, so I've had my images everywhere. You know, TV, film, magazines, images of ETs. I actually had. Now that I'm thinking back, I had my own art show, private art show in Santa Fe, New Mexico, back in the early 90s, of my ET art. I had actually done some Polaroids of an alien model that I manipulated the Polaroids and blew them up and did limited edition prints. but boy, I had completely forgotten about that.
But, Kim, for real, I mean, you've never really taken a real picture of an ET.
No, I have not.
Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about your own personal abduction experiences, if you don't mind, Kim. I believe that first abduction happened in Malibu. Is that right?
It did. Most of my abductions happened in Malibu. That's where they started. Like I said, I was the first woman in the cameraman's union in Hollywood. So I lived and worked in Malibu most of my
career. I'm very familiar with that area. I used to live in Santa Monica.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, the industry, you have to be there. So I lived in Santa Monica as well. And when I was it was in the summer of 88. I was living in this big, beautiful castle on the bottom floor. It's still there. It's amazing. It's at Sunset Boulevard and PCH, and a little bit north of it. And the whole bottom floor was nothing but one big, huge room with three arched windows, tall arched windows that overlooked the Pacific Coast. And I came home late one night, and since this house of ours was just, we basically had the bottom floor of this huge castle, my boyfriend was asleep in the bed behind me, and I just pulled a chair up to the window, and I was being quiet not to wake him up because he was an early riser. Anybody in the movie industry knows that story. And I was staring out the window, and I noticed a light on the horizon that jetted across the Santa Monica Bay at breathtaking speeds from Pacific Palisades to Point Doom in just a matter of a second. And as I looked at this thing, I really wanted to wake my boyfriend up, but I knew if I did, at the speed that thing moved, it would have been gone by the time I woke him up. So I just sat there, I remained staring at it all alone, and the next thing I know, this thing decided to give me a visit. And I don't know if it just noticed that I was observing it. I don't know how this happened. I say I think it responded to my thoughts, or maybe it was there intentionally to get my attention. I don't know, but it took another jet. It landed right in front of, can't say landed, it appeared and it was floating over the beach in front of my windows. And it was a large moon-shaped object glowing as if it were, you know, internally glowing with kind of soft edges. I saw a silhouette of a couple of entities inside of this glowing sphere. And the next thing I know, it took, you know, it just took a diagonal shot across the heavens and disappeared into the stars. And that was the beginning of my 7 or 8 years of contact.
7+ years of contact experience? How did that happen, Kim? Did you seek them out, or did they seek you out?
They sought me. They sought me, or they found me, or perhaps they have known me longer than I have known them. A few weeks after that incident, I woke up and I was in the middle of a typical genetic abduction. So that started just years of...
So you were taken while you were sleeping?
They took me, I would say that most of my experience, not most, half of my experiences, I was asleep, awakened, knocked out, or taken from an acutely aware state. Many times I would go to bed and I would start to go to sleep and I would feel a presence in the room. I wasn't asleep. I would just get into bed and I would feel this electricity fill the room and my consciousness would heighten, and the next thing I know, there's a gray there and they're taking me away, or I would be, you know, immediately transferred to another place. So my experiences, my first conscious experience started, I went to bed, I went to sleep, and I woke up in a craft. And then there were just different combinations of being awake, being unconscious, being knocked out, taking from a conscious state, all of the above.
Kim, as you know, I've done a lot of shows about abductions, And spirituality plays an important part. And even religion comes into play sometimes with these ETs. I have one guy say that the ETs tried to save him. Did any of your experiences involve an ET who talked to you about God, for instance?
I had an experience where an ET came to me and stood in front of my face and said, "You are us." And at that moment, I became one with that entity, one with all entities, one with God, one with the universe. It was a nirvana experience. And at that moment, I knew that there was something way, way bigger than my little mind could comprehend about who they were, what I was, what was going on in the universe. And that is how I believe that they have spirituality, because they gave me the most powerful spiritual experience I've ever had.
I guess what I'm asking, Kim, is you had a lot of relationships, a lot of back and forth, to and fro with ETs. And philosophically, where are they? I mean, are they deep thinkers? Do they believe in religion, philosophy? What do you think? Do they believe in God?
I don't know that. We never had conversations.
Okay.
Okay, here's another question for you then, Kim. Why don't they go to our leaders, the movers and shakers of the world? I mean, if they want to change the world, as you say, why not go to the top?
Well, you know, my answer to that is because the leaders wouldn't get it. The leaders are so corrupt. Why would they go to the leaders? And if they do go to the leaders, if the genetic program is about advancing the species, then there are only so many people that are in the genetic upgrade, and they might not be part of...
Who makes those decisions?
Only God, I guess.
Okay, let's get back to the book. You got a great idea here, Kim. I hope you have great sales success. It's a good idea. Big coffee table book with pictures, and at the same time, different people telling about their experiences in the abduction arena.
Yeah, I'm already... I received so many stories that... I worked on this. Like I said, this is 15 years in the making, but I worked on this 24/7 for the last year, and it's finally ready to be picked up. I received so many stories for the first book that I already started the second book. So there's going to be The Art of Close Encounters, Volume 2. And hopefully this one will be easier for me to do, because I've done it now, and it was very, very difficult to do. But hopefully I've learned all the lessons, and now I know how to self-publish, and I can really enjoy the making of the second one instead of it being such a difficult venture. But it was definitely worth it. It's beautiful. It came out so much better than I expected. I really fought to get black, rich black pages so that the color art, you know, would pop, and the subject matter is just, you know, beautiful with the black. And I have the cover of the book is a matte finish, and I put a spot varnish on the eyes of the aliens so they glisten. It's beautiful, and it's compelling, and I think anybody who's had an experience will find their experience. Anybody who hasn't had an experience will find it fascinating. I'm hoping that it will cross over into mainstream.
Kim, I know they can go to your website and order that book, and it's a great book. And I hear nothing but good things about it. Have you ever thought that maybe that's why they made contact with you? Maybe Kim Carlson is chosen?
Yes, I've thought about that several times. When I wrote my first book, it destroyed my life. I had worked my way through 8 years of college. I had a wonderful relationship. I was living on the beach in Malibu. I had everything that I had ever worked for, and I was just beginning to really, you know, feel the greatness of life, and these experiences started happening to me. And they prodded me to write my book, you know, the truth was more important. There's some truth out there that is more important than my being a photographer and my working in Hollywood, because I wouldn't have given all of that up for nothing, and I did. And if it was only for the, you know, hundreds of letters that I received thanking me from people that weren't alone, maybe that was it. But the message that I got from the aliens while I was doing the first book was definitely it's time to save Mother Earth from her inhabitants, and by you putting out a book may get a few more people thinking in that direction. So that was my sense. I went ahead and did it. When I sat down to do this last book, it was a mission. I didn't leave the computer for a year. I just felt like this book absolutely had to be born as soon as possible. And I think I was probably influenced by other influences.
So, Kim, there seems to be lots of ET, UFO reported activity these days. When I first started many decades ago, we really had to scrape to come up with an hour show on UFO sightings and contact and things like that. Now we could probably do one every day. What do you make of all this?
Sure. I think there's a lot of activity all of a sudden that seems to be just increasing every day, and I hope it's for the reason of getting this ready for contact. You know, my little brother didn't speak to me for 5 years after I wrote my book because it embarrassed the family so much. And do you know that he called me from Yuma, Arizona last night, and he said, "You're not going to believe what happened to me." He's never believed any of this. And he said, "I'm standing here," and he said, "my neighbor came and knocked on my door and said, I want you to come out and help me confirm my sanity." And he said, sure, what's going on? And they walked out, and they looked up to the sky, and he said that there was a white cigar-shaped thing hovering in the sky off in the distance that had, the neighbor said he'd been looking at it for an hour and hadn't moved, and my brother watched it for an hour or two before we hung up last night, and I said, oh my God, if my brother, the biggest skeptic in the world, is calling me and he's seen a UFO in Yuma, Arizona, then we are moving towards disclosure, not from the government, but from, I believe, the people and the ETs deciding to just speed it up.
Kim, we're almost out of time, but you have to tell people how to get the book. I mean, you're self-publishing it, so tell people how to get it.
Since I'm self-publishing, you won't be able to buy the book in the stores. It will only be available through my website, which I said is theartofcloseencounters.com. And I want people to know the book's a great deal. A book like this in the bookstores would be, you know, $70, $80, $100. I got the price down to $34.95, and the shipping is low as you can possibly get it. And I think, like I said, if you know someone in your family who is like my little brother, who's a skeptic, and you want to trick them into getting information into their heads, this is the way to do it. Have this book on your tabletop, and there's no way somebody can walk by this book and not open it up and hopefully get them interested. And if you have had an experience, you're going to love all of the different varieties of experiences.
Kim Carlson, thanks for coming on the air and being very candid with us. We wish you lots of luck with the book. We urge people to consider getting it. It's a quality product. Thanks,
Kim.
Thank
you, Jerry. We'll do it again sometime.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Tales of High Strangeness. Jerry Pippin's Parazone. Check out our stories of the horrific, the interesting, the spiritual, on the paranormal pages of jerrypippin.com. We're going to continue our show on abductions now with a man who came on the scene about 3 years ago, maybe almost four now, Jim Sparks. We're going to play a show we did with him that we recorded at the UFO Congress when it was being held in Laughlin, Nevada. And basically, the UFO Congress has moved. It's now over in Phoenix. It's still about the same time in February. And we'll keep you informed on that conference. It's always a major conference. But we're going to play this show all the way through in its entirety. And you'll notice it's a little dated, but it's very, very interesting listening. Jim Sparks and his version of Abductions.
This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from the UFO Congress on the beautiful Colorado River in Laughlin at the Aquarius Casino Resort. And we have a man who's really, I think this is the buzz of the whole convention here this year, Jim Sparks. And he has a book called The Keeper, and we'll be talking about it in a minute. We'll introduce Jim, but I want to introduce Paula Harris again, who's helping us. And Paula, she's from Area 51 magazine out of Italy. How are you?
I'm doing really well. You're right. This is a big top story, and this is one of the reasons I'm here is to interview Jim, because we're going to be doing a story on him in Italy.
And we have Eileen Dune as our producer today. Actually, she's the PR person for... Well, Jim, I hope you didn't mind us barring her, Jim.
No, not at all.
Okay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's get right into this. Why don't you kind of start filling us in on, before you wrote the book, exactly what was happening and when did it start?
Yeah, well, it started for me in mid-1988. Prior to 1988, as far as I was concerned, I had no inkling or iota that abductions took place, and particularly the way they do now, maybe in the tens and hundreds of thousands over the years, maybe even more. Also, prior to '88, I had a mind that went like, well, yeah, it's possible there can be extraterrestrial beings. Maybe there could be.
In other words, you were open, but you really weren't looking for any kind of contact or anything like that.
None whatsoever.
Didn't think that would be possible, even.
None
whatsoever. What was this first event? How did that come about?
It was dreamlike. I had what I thought was a reoccurring dream that something or some things were coming into my home, escorting me off the bed, walking me down the hallway into the guest room, and we had at the time a floor level window in the guest room, and then I would literally walk through the window with whatever these things were. My peripheral vision in this dream was shot, so I couldn't really see what it was. It took me out, walked across the lawn, took me out to the woods, brought me back the same way, and put me back to bed. And that just kept happening several times a week for a few months. And one evening, that dream was more vivid, meaning that I became like wide-eyed conscious during different parts of that episode. And when it came to the walking through the window part, I was scared that, my God, I'm going to walk through my bedroom window. And then it was just extremely vivid. When I got up the next day, I went into the guest room, and I was shocked to see the heel of my foot in the lawn, and the ball and toes of my foot embedded in the carpet.
You're talking about imprints, or the literally?
Literally, the imprints of your feet.
Okay,
like as if you walked, you
right.
Freshly vacuumed the carpet.
Right,
you could
right.
See your toes.
I understand.
Okay, at that time, our lawn had thousands of these little, what I called honeysuckle flowers, that would stick to your feet when you walked across the lawn. But what made this thing creepy was the fact that embedded in the heel was the flowers in the lawn. You could see it. And then the ball, the feet, and the toes that imprinted on the carpet, the flowers had drugged through the window. But there was a window, a solid glass window, drapes, blinds. And so how can, you know, the material from outside be on the inside of the carpet? Then as my footprints
sure, I got you.
Worked their way into the bedroom, the grass and the flowers were embedded in it. But there was these other little tiny, like little feet,
little paw prints or something. What were they? Were three toes or what?
You know, they weren't as clear as my feet.
Okay,
and I wasn't into.
Does
the
that
alien
mean that
thing.
They're lighter or?
I had no clue what was going on.
Yeah.
I wasn't thinking aliens. I wasn't thinking anything, and it looked like, I think what you just said, the best way to describe it was like animal feet.
Okay.
Like, almost like your dogs were doing that or something.
Were you married at the time? Did anybody see this? I mean, did you have anybody in the house?
I was married at the time. In the course of all of this, my wife was part of the abduction scenario with these grays. But there was one thing that was extremely strong. She was not to have conscious recall. I was not to be able to interact or relate to her about any of these episodes that later followed and abductions that later followed. And it's a good time for me to say it. I mean, I really learned the hard way, but I learned fast that any time I brought this subject up, and, you know, when you're married and you know your wife's face and you've been with her day after day, month after month, year after year, and you know how she responds, she would always have this, like, programmed response when I'd say, "Charissa, you know you saw this, you saw it with me," and I'd be holding her shoulders and looking at the right flat in the eyes of my wife's face and say, "What do you think about this?" Her facial expression would be that I'm not familiar with, and she would respond the same silly way, like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And if I probed any further and she started to remember, then she would respond violently and make life even more miserable. So I learned that in whatever program at that time they were had for her, or agenda for her, was not for her and I to interact with.
Basically, I was, "Shut up, I don't want to hear about this."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I learned fast that if I left that alone, it was just better to leave that alone.
What what would you try to tell her? What would you just bring up what they look like and things like this?
During the course of that followed, I would see her on board from time to time. I'd never see her for long periods of time, but I'd see her, and I'd get glimpses of her, and I'd go, "Oh, my God, it's my wife." And then sometimes I know she would see me. There was one point where we were in the living room, and again, I had her gently by the shoulders, and she was just rambling on with this nonsense that wasn't even her words, like programmed words. I said, "Charissa, come on, come on, come on." And she says, "Jim, I know what you're talking about, but we're not allowed to talk about it." And I got a real genuine response from her. Another thing she had said during the course of that, boy, I haven't shared this with anybody, so
no,
you're getting an interview here.
Well, good.
That was my question.
And the next words out of her mouth in
Ms. Paula, we'll give her the credit. Go ahead, Jim.
No, I'm curious because when you have somebody verifying in the house that this happened to you, when you have a wife or children, it becomes a whole other world because it helps other people that have wife and children.
Sure.
So when you're sharing this with us, and also when you answer now, would you please answer that what her purpose was, why they took her?
I'm sure I didn't write this in the book, and I rarely do I say it, so it's a new thing coming out. But because I just stay away from that thing with her, and I always have. And we're very close. We're divorced now. We're friends. And I still, if I touch on it, she kind of laughs, but she still won't. But
you know, not to get personal, but was this part of the reason you got a divorce?
It played a big part of it.
Okay.
It did. And then there were other reasons.
Well, sure.
With
sure.
Us. Okay. So both of them didn't help. But nonetheless, it was, she says, I know we're not supposed to talk about it. And I says, "What are they, Charissa?" She goes, and I didn't like these words, "They're my helpers from heaven."
Uh-huh.
And now, you got to understand, she was an extremely religious person, deeply religious.
Okay.
So anything other than God or Christ
this is
would
how
be
she
bad.
Interpreted it. This is her interpretation.
Her helpers from heaven.
That's
and then she went into a violent rage, like, "We're not supposed to talk, and you're crazy," and, you know, reversed the whole thing. And so it her response was so awful from that point on that, well, it always was. It always, that it wasn't even worth touching. So
you
it was better just not to
right,
say anything. Yeah. So that's how it was. It was if these things weren't going on.
She felt they were helpers from heaven. Who
helpers
did you think
heaven.
They were?
In the early months, first I had no clue whatsoever. But I think as things progressed, I learned that these guys screen image. And what I mean by screen image is, whatever it takes to subdue and handle a human being with the least resistance is what they'll always do. They'll always take the path of least resistance that works. Their minds can project images to lead you to believe it's something that you're comfortable with or uncomfortable with, meaning that if you're a very religious person, then they would come across with, we're angels from God, and we're here to please lay on this gurney, okay? And so if you're into that, that's what you're thinking, you'll just cooperate. If you're, like, extremely afraid of, let's say, demonic beings or demonic forces, they'll do just a flip, where the devil will hurt you if you don't listen to us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there was a point where they came on to me as the religious thing. When they came on to me with the religious thing, like, we're angels of God and all this, I go, yeah, right. God had flies around and his angels and UFOs, okay? Then the next ploy was, because I was always angry, and I had that focused anger, and I had that focused hate, and I wasn't buying any of it. I knew it was technology. Nothing other than that. I didn't know what they were. And then they came across at one point as, all right, we're demonic, and we're evil, and we'll hurt you if you don't cooperate. And I'm going, yeah, right. Well, turn me loose, and I'll squeeze your fat demonic
yeah, right.
head off
I
your
understand
skinny little
that.
Neck, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I can't do that to the devil, can I? And so that kind of tortured logic, they couldn't retaliate. So in those early months, they tried those games. Now, I know that with abductees, they do all kinds of different things to get you to cooperate, and then they primarily take the memory away before you go back. But in my case, those games that they pulled earlier, I caught on to them fast, I resisted them fast, and they stopped doing that. So even early in the early months, they stopped that right away. So the rest of it was what they really were.
And what is that? What they really are?
They are 95 to 98% of interaction for this person, myself, has been what are commonly referred to as grays. They're not forthcoming. Borrowed that term from somebody that's very close to me on the forthcoming thing. That's the best way to describe it.
Are they little robotic beings, though, or do they look more like cloned beings?
There's two types.
Okay.
There's what I call the true aliens, and then there's the worker beings. The worker beings is, in my experience, is what's encountered by most abductees, better than 90%, and they think they're aliens for good reason, because they're three and a half feet tall. Their heads are very big. They do have the almond-shaped eyes, but I know them to be half robotic and half biological. They are created beings just for that work. I've seen these beings with what are commonly referred to as reptilians carrying on tasks. Okay. I've seen them with the grays carrying on tasks. And very rare occasions, I've seen them with something that looks humanoid, that they wear robes, but it's very rare. A couple of occasions with that over the 19 years. And so I know they're created worker beings. But the grays themselves are a couple of feet taller, a foot and a half, 4 feet, between 4 and 5 feet taller. Their eyes are much bigger than ours, but certainly not the giant almond-shaped eyes like people describe as to what they believe are the aliens, and I say are the drones. And the gray aliens that are beings... Also, their skin is their clothes, but their skin is like, it's a leather-like skin on their face, and you can see wrinkles, and it's hard to distinguish one from the other, but if you get chances to look at them close, you can see differences between one and the other, where
they're,
the drones are
individual.
All
you're saying they're individual personalities.
And rank and file.
And rank and file.
Absolutely rank and file.
Did they ever give you a name?
Twice. I almost called the book Star People.
Okay.
And the reason was during the first 6 years, which were pretty much very painful, traumatic, I always found myself in the same place, which was on board this craft, in this room, sitting on this bench, paralyzed. In front of me was a table, a little bit longer than the one I'm sitting in front of, that had a screen on it. I called it a screen table. It was a teaching machine. It could interact with you. It was artificial intelligence. But what was eerie about this machine was that you can sense living tissue or living thoughts, both with the, you know, and these guys don't have the same social outlook as we do. So for how many thousands of years ago, they've gone beyond not worrying about whether something's half biological and half robotic.
Right. They're
and
used
they're
to
past
that.
Of all that. But you could always sense that sense of there's life in this machine.
Yeah. I started to say, did you feel like the table itself was alive?
Yes. Yes. And but I got over all that discomfort as the years progressed. And then there was this wall with a screen on it, too. But and that's where I always found myself. I lost the thought of the
names. Yeah. The names.
Okay. Oh,
we're going to take a break, and we'll get back here in just a second and follow up what Paula was talking about.
Yeah,
we're talking with Jim Sparks and the Keepers. And I notice here that John Mack wrote the foreword.
Yes.
Did you tell him these stories? Did he investigate with you?
Yeah, actually, I met with John several years before this.
Okay,
we'll get into that when we come right back.
This is Jerry Pippin. We're broadcasting from the Aquarius Casino Resort in Laughlin, Nevada at the UFO Congress. Don't go away.
The biggest secret ever is about to be revealed. Fast Walkers, UFO and Alien Disclosure.
Words you were never meant to hear.
It's clear we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate.
This is the biggest secret in the history of the human race, the known modern history of government.
Photos you were never meant to see. Video you never knew existed. People you were never meant to meet.
As Jack Nicholson would say, you can't handle the truth.
Essentially everything that you would want to know has been covered up.
Things you were never meant to know about.
No one has produced a higher quality, better produced DVD. Anytime, anywhere. Fast Walkers now available on DVD for only $19.95 at shopjerrypippin.com. This is Jerry Pippin, and our guest is Jim Sparks, and it's the talk, really, of the conference and the talk of the UFO world, the Keepers. And Paula, you saw his talk yesterday, his presentation. How did it go?
Oh, it was fascinating. I mean, he had people riveted because his story is real, and he's one of the only people that has total recall without hypnosis. I mean, he remembers details. And I think that he said it was done on purpose, you know, that he would remember this story. I don't know what the reason is. Maybe because he needed to tell it. But the question that we had asked before the break was, did these people say who they are, and were there any names connected with this?
Well, say one thing about their nature, several things about their nature, is the fact that they don't like questions. They absolutely can't stand questions. Now, why? Because it's always the same thing. When they encounter human beings, we're always going to say, where are you from? Why are you here? And what's it like where you're from? And we can't help ourselves. We're going to want to do that. So what I've learned over the years is they'll tell you when they're ready. Don't ask a lot of questions. But in those early years of encounter with myself and them, there was tasks that they wanted me to perform, experiments that I had to be a part of, this language thing that I've written about and talked about, converting our letters into symbols. And I was highly, it's going to answer the name thing here in a second, it's going somewhere. I was highly resistant to anything on their agenda. I fought them tooth and nail. Any way I could mess them up, I always did. However, it was based on reward and punishment if I cooperated.
Literally like we treat animals.
Yes.
And one-word commands.
Or prisoners.
Yes, and one-word commands. No, yes, sit, you know, almost like that, okay? No, rarely was it, hey, how are you? It was never that. So nonetheless, there was one session where I had done particularly well and cooperated particularly well. I just wanted to get out of there. So I learned as time went, the more I cooperated, the faster I could go home. And where, as part of the reward session, at times it was different things they rewarded you with, was maybe play with gizmos or whatever, and or ask a question and get an answer.
Yeah.
Okay? So one of my questions was, you get corny answers, and you get these corny answers, and you go like, but it's the truth. And you're expecting all this elaborate stuff, okay? Who are you people? Where are you from? Or people, where are you things from? And the response was, we're star people. But I got angry. I go, hey, I'm a people.
Yeah.
You're not a people. Let's get this clear. I'm a people. You're not a people. But star people, meaning they're from the stars. Okay, I was going to name the book originally Star People, because that's what they said they were. Then I had an experience several years later, just before the book came out, where what was so cool about this was it was witnessed by several other people, too. So it's always nice when you have an experience like this and there's UFOs and other people are there to verify it. It just makes you feel so much better because you're telling people what's going on and it's verified. They refer to themselves as the Keepers.
Plural.
And the Keepers are here to take their people to a better place. The Keepers are here to take their people home to a better place.
They're considering us their people?
Yeah. Or whatever the responsibility.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And not that I'm agreeing with this and I'm saying that I'm embracing alien culture and this is, you know, but I keep a healthy suspicion distance But things are starting to come out over the last 19 years that are leading the way with the environmental issue and things we need to do and so on and so forth.
We're going to get into some of that in a minute.
But the keepers, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, go ahead. I'm very interested in what you were saying about the keepers.
When they said the keepers, what I came across, I was driving on a highway from Naples, Florida, to Fort Myers Beach, and it was in between the two when a craft appeared. But it appeared in front of me on the road, and it was so odd. It looked because the keeper's crafts are diamond shaped. They look like two pyramids, upside one upright and the other upside down on top of each other. And they change color. They reflect light. Mm-hmm. They can be a whitewash white, and that, I associate that with the keepers. And as I was driving down the highway, it looked like a sailboat sailing across the road. Okay, now, yeah, there's water and golf and all that over there in Florida, but there wasn't the water and there wasn't the bay there. So here's this sail going across the road, but it was the top of a craft, and the bottom half of it was just going right through the dirt and the earth as if it didn't even exist.
Transparent, almost.
Yeah, really weird. And so, but your mind at first goes, it's a sailboat. Mm-hmm. And that's the way they do things. So most people driving wouldn't even think that it's not even in the water because that's the way they do the mine. But at that point, they wanted me to see what they were. And here's this thing looks like it's sailing through the street. But then when it came up, it rose up and then went to a 45-degree angle. It was a craft. It appeared as a craft. And then what was transmitted out telepathically as I was in the vehicle were the keepers are here to take their people home to a better place. Not world, because I thought it would be world. It was place, the keepers. But they burnt an image in my mind, which was I saw them collecting seeds of every animal, every plant, humans, everything. And you can see it in this craft as it departed in my head. That was 10 years ago. And so the keepers was something 10 years ago. No, it was more like 7-8 years ago. So star people was the first thing they used. The keepers was the second thing they used, but I stuck with star people up until just before I wrote the book, or the book came out and said, I'm going to change it to the keepers because it's more appropriate. So they refer to themselves, they answer your question in a longabout way, to two different things.
So they're predicting some problems on down the road.
Yeah.
Which is a scenario that a lot of people and a lot of contactees have. Did they give you specific details about this? Even if you don't, you know, you feel you shouldn't say it, you could say yes or no.
Well, it was 6 years of being paralyzed for me on board in the same room, and after 6 years, I took part in a mass abduction where I was actually freed up for the first time to move around, and it was unique in a lot of different ways. I wasn't paralyzed. I was calming people. It was a mass abduction. And I got to see an agenda that they were doing on a humongous global basis, which were they were picking up people all over the globe, taking them to one destination or spot, in which this case was the one I talk about a lot. There were several other things. But in this case was a clearing in the woods. Mm-hmm. And then other crafts came and took them to something that was a bigger ship, to get a lesson on the environment, environmental lesson. And primarily the condition of what the planet was like, and then what the planet is like, and saying we're killing our planet. For myself personally, soon after that, what I saw was many, many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of human beings being indoctrinated under this understanding.
Okay.
Which they were monitors at desks, and then they showed the pristine beauty of the planet before and now and what we're doing to it. Then it was given to me to take responsibility for the rainforest.
Yeah, you had mentioned that.
And so I formed a foundation called Your Earth. It is not active yet. It's what I've learned throughout all of this stuff is timing. No matter how bad I want to do something or somebody may else want to involving them, if the timing has to be on their agenda, and then it works. If the timing is not at the time that they have proposed, it does not. You're just wrestling against, you're wrestling, and it goes nowhere. So like now, things are starting to go because they said to go in this direction.
They did.
Oh, yeah.
That's why, why you wrote the book? Is that why you're talking right now, that this is the time because something's happening?
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So we're talking about something happening, and that because there's a lot of things going on planetary. I mean, your book, a lot of people are speaking, the O'Hare, you know, airport sighting over London, 15 UFOs. So whatever they predicted was happening, is that close at hand?
Well, it's coinciding with the fact that we reached something that made me sad. To answer your question, environmentally, yes, okay. And I'm seeing things that are extremely positive, which I hadn't seen over the years. At the time, even with my book and me talking about it, and then things that are happening globally with this awareness, and commitments are starting to be made. But the point being is that what's bothered me for many years, and I was frustrated because there's nothing I could do about it, after that assignment, so to speak, which was the rainforest, I had a visitation. See, now I used to get pulled out of my living room or out of my bedroom in a horrific, traumatic way for many years, like most abductees, but only stayed conscious throughout it. And the transport is not easy on your body.
But really? What does that feel like?
It's first you hear the hard way. I say there's two ways to go. The easy way and the hard way is what I say. The easy
you get a
way.
Choice?
No. Depends on what they're doing.
Okay.
If the crafts are on the ground and they come to get you, or escort you out of your home, they create a field. For the best way I can describe it, a field. It's an energy field that renders invisibility, the ability to walk through walls, and they literally are holding your arms and they're escorting you, and you're walking through a wall or window on board. That's easy on you. The hard way is when the crafts are in flight and they pull you. I call it being pulled. The first sensation of any knowledge of something's about to happen is you start to hear this low RPM or whirling, whipping sound, like and it just gets faster and higher in pitch and faster and faster and faster. Then you get the sensation in the pit of your stomach that starts working its way up to your chest. This is scary. Excuse me.
The sensation, is it fear or more like an upset stomach?
Like an energy. You can feel
feel something in there.
An energy that's being like beamed at you in a sense. And now you know they're hovering or flying by. And so whatever it is that they're focusing on you to get you or to transport matter. And when it works its way up to your torso, and then when it hits your chest, your heart just races beyond your wildest imagination, and adrenaline just drops into your system.
Are we talking like a roller coaster feeling?
That comes next.
Okay.
What comes next is this sensation of extreme acceleration, but instead of going up, you feel like you're being pulled down. Now, while you're hearing this whipping, whirling sound, your heart's racing out of its chest. Adrenaline is poured and dumped into your system. Now you're getting this acceleration, and all you can do is scream inside your head. You can't even open your mouth, and you're just going, I don't want to die. You always feel like it's going to kill you, and then you black out. When you come to, you're nauseous, you're sick, but you're at point B. So that's going the hard way. It's happened so many times, I've lost count. I adjust right away to it. I'm not as frightened by it as I used to be.
Yeah, because you know what's coming.
I know I always live.
Yeah.
I know. So where were we going in the transport to the...
And now, when they take you up to... I'm interested in the moving ship when they're going by
right. So
and lock you up. I mean, is that like a tractor beam or something?
It's something you can't see.
I understand that because you're it.
Exactly. Yeah. And if I could say, it looks like a beam, but you can't see it. And, I know where I was going to go with that.
Positive experience you had with
that. That's when you're pulled. Now, the interaction has evolved tremendously in the last 13 years relative to the first six. It's 19 altogether. So interaction is almost on human terms, where I know where to go, and I go to that specified place, like physically drive myself there, and then have a meeting. However, there was one being, this is what bothered me about the environmental thing, that I had met up with, who expressed that as far as the rainforest is concerned, we had at the time 4 or 5 years to stop the destruction to where it could go back to what it was. And that 4 and 5 year period has already passed.
That's what I'd say. I bet it's passed.
It has. However...
What do they say now?
It's not all negative. It's still positive.
Okay.
But what we can't do is bring back what we've lost. what he means by, but we can bring it back.
Okay, with that, that's kind of an encouraging note. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and expound on that a little bit. And the overall message, and Paula has some very interesting things to ask you as well. And I'm kind of a nuts and bolts guy. I'm kind of interested in this craft, and you got hundreds of people up there. Are you standing around in a gymnasium or something, or what?
That's what's kind of weird about it is things seem to expand and shrink dimensionally,
by
and it's
by
all
the
relative.
By the need.
We'll be right back.
Can't do that yet. We got to break for a commercial. We can't expand or stretch or even contract. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin. We're at the UFO Conference with Paula Harris. And, of course, an incredible, incredible story. The Keepers is the name of the book with Jim Sparks. It happened almost 60 years ago, but the debate still rages. Did an alien spacecraft crash outside Roswell, New Mexico in 1947? The most concise and complete series ever broadcast on Roswell, direct from Roswell. New programs added weekly. Check it out on the UFO Conference on JerryPippin.com. This is Jerry Pippin, and we have Jim Sparks with us. The name of the book is The Keepers, and it's 19 years of incredible experiences. Paula Harris is with us, and you've traveled the world, Paula. This is probably the most detailed thing we've heard.
Well, it's wonderful because he can recall it. It's not a hypnotic kind of recall. And also, he's been able to figure out why. I mean, he's been able to reason why they took him, what the program is, and so forth, because so many contactees don't know the reason. Now, what he did yesterday in this presentation was show a documentary that had a lot of famous people, John Macklin, DeHow, just a lot of famous researchers in it. But this documentary was made by a person that was on his mass abduction. So I was asking myself the whole time, was this programmed by the Keepers for us to see? Was that why the documentary was made? Because the man that was interviewing him was in the mass abduction.
Well, to answer it directly and then expound on it, yes, it was. What I got to see in the experience, that whole first experience of not being paralyzed, everything was elation about it. Mm-hmm. Elation to the fact that I got privy that there's a plan by these guys, which is an environmental thing. I was privy to the fact that during this mass abduction, I could see all the intricate workings of it, from how they get people, how they bring them on board, how they hook them up, how they put them on this monitor thing to get which I hear abductees say that they're environmentally inclined since they've been abducted, but most of them don't remember why. Mm-hmm. And I know why, because I see what they put them through. And it was elation to the fact that there was one individual that I was paying a lot of personal attention to during that mass abduction that lasted a couple of hours. And then I got to see that person in real life here. And he was part of that scenario. So maybe I should go into a little bit about what the abduction was.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That'd be good.
Doug. Mm-hmm. Okay. I got pulled. I found myself in a clearing in the woods. And so it was the first time I had ever not been on board. Okay, mm-hmm. And I was able to move around. I would say that the clearing in the woods was about 100 yards, like a football field. It almost looked like the size of that. I was standing up, and below me were people just piled on the ground. I'd say 12 or 15 of them, mostly nude. Some of them were in their nightgowns and panties and underwear and nightclothes. So obviously they were in bed when they got pulled, primarily paralyzed, sprawled on the ground. There was one guy standing to my right who was fully dressed. I remember his clothes. He had a short sleeve shirt, collar on, regular slacks, and he wore brown leather shoes. And he was standing up, and he was mostly... if paralyzed is the right word, zombie-like, days, and he just kept going, I was driving my car. There was a woman on the ground to my left. She was in her nightclothes, and she was in the fetal position, and she was just rocking back and forth, just horrified. And then there was a gray standing in this group. To the left was another pile of people in the same position with one gray, and to the left of them was another pile of people with one gray. So it was a mass abduction about to take place. So they were gathering people at this point for the other ships to come and get them. So how they got there, I'm not sure. But I figured they got pulled the hard way, judging from the state that they were in. When we saw three lights to the left, and they came, and I'm making an abbreviated version of this, and they one came over my group of people, another one from the horizon just as fast as can be, came over the second one, synchronized so beautifully, and then the third one came over the third pile of people. It was an overcast night, so they just looked like balls of light at that point. But the one that came over our pile first descended, and I saw, for the very first time, the outside of a ship instead of being on board. I was able to move. I could see the outside of the ship. But prior to that ship descending, when I was standing there and this guy was complaining in days and I was in my car and he was confused and the girl was rocking back and forth in a traumatic state.
Yes, right.
The gray in that pile said to me, calm her. And then I got it out of order yesterday. I said, calm him. It was calm her first. Calm her. And I thought to myself, well, man, I got a job. I'm actually participating.
Yeah, right. You've graduated.
Right. Exactly. You know, so I'm not claiming to embrace alien culture, but it's like the Helsinki syndrome. You know, you're a trustee in prison
sure,
now.
Right.
But it's better to move around than to be in some corner in isolation.
Sure.
And then I can learn more here. So I wouldn't put my arm on her shoulder and said, you're going to be fine. You're going to get through this. And hopefully I'm going through this quick enough to get this in to where it leads to Doug and your question. I think I am. Mm-hmm. And then I said, then they're going to take you into this room, and they're going to teach you this alphabet. And then the alien telepathic voice said, which was kind of funny, I laugh about it now, which, you're telling her too much, just calm her. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, you're going to be fine, you're going to be okay. The guy, he kept complaining, he was nauseous, he wanted to throw up, he didn't know where he was. So I kept talking to him to calm him. So I was very close to this person, his face was in my face. I was holding his arm, I was holding his hand, I was touching him, telling him he's going to be fine. When the ships descended, I saw the exterior of the ship was something that I thought wouldn't look like. I thought it would look real like a streamlined and stealthy looking, and it was like the bottom of it was like shaped like an egg. It wasn't even perfectly round, but it was white. It had windows all the way around it, and you could see this activity behind the windows of running around and movement. And then it was spherical over the top of it. And then a light came down over our pile of people, including myself, a white, white, bright light with a hue of blue. And when I was looking up at that craft through the light, and the one that descended to the left, and that light came on, and then it was all in sequence and all in order, I just stepped out in front of that crowd, and I had my hands up in the air, and I'm going, they're beautiful, they're beautiful. And I blacked out. When I came to, I was in a corridor. And in the corridor were all the people that were all piled on the ground. They were standing up, and then I was told to lead them. I led them into a room that was about the size now of a gymnasium or basketball court stadium. There was all kinds of activity all the way to the back walls of it. I could see people, and I could see aliens. So it was like mixed working together, just a buzz of activity. Then my next instructions were to seat them, which I should explain what I was going to seat them on. Also in this room were rows and rows and rows, and it just amazed me what I was seeing, and rows and rows and rows of what looked like benches, work desks with these monitors. Now, I didn't know anything about computers in those days, nothing. So, but it wasn't a computer monitor. It was just a different kind of a screen, and it was to seat them. And as I started seating one, and I came and I seated this guy that was next to me again. So now again, I'm close to this person. I'm looking at his face. I'm looking at his physique. He was the first one. When I seated him, I came back. I got curious. I started looking around. They didn't want me to do that, and I blacked out. When I came to, I found myself seated in front of my screen. And everybody in the room that was, everybody that was, the pile of people that were
that,
down.
Your group.
Were seated. And there was maybe 100 or 200 more others from earlier that were seated or had gotten seated from when they were continually bringing people into this room. When the monitors all lit up, they all lit up at the same time. And by the way, something was hooked to us. And I think it explains to a certain degree scoop marks. Because it was intravenous in a way that it was hooked right into your flesh, either in your arm or calves of your leg. And what I felt like that was something to stimulate excitement or stimulate stimuli. So stimuli would be much more stronger when you look at it because we were getting an environmental lesson. On the monitors came, the first scene was a beautiful, pristine, gorgeous sea with filled with fish, a beautiful blue sky. And so a normal reaction to something that beautiful, you would go just like, oh, wow, that's really pretty, right? But the turquoise and the blue with whatever was hooked up to us, you just went, it took your breath away. You went, oh, my God, the beauty of our planet. It was just so drop-dead gorgeous, and you were just so engrossed by it. It took your whole emotion and just you were absorbed by this, and that's how everybody was. They were just totally mesmerized by the beauty of these scenes. And it was scene after earth scene after earth scene, and you could tell that these were scenes taken perhaps hundreds, if not thousands, of years ago before the earth was untainted. Just beautiful. And you just couldn't help but absorb yourself. Then each scene started getting ugly, where the sea started looking brown, the fish were bloated and floating, and then the telepathic message for everybody as these scenes kept changing and getting uglier and more polluted and uglier was, you're killing your planet, your planet is dying, you're killing your planet is dying.
This telepathic message that you got from the screen, was it like an announcer's voice or something?
PA, like a PA for everybody.
Uh-huh.
Where usually the telepathy is one-on-one kind of thing.
Was it a human voice or was it a robotic voice?
You hear in your head a voice that sounds almost like your own.
Okay.
And so it's human. It's not like it,
there's no soundtrack with this.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so it's like, but it's not. And you sometimes you'll hear it in different sounds, but it's definitely not.
Right. It's not right. Not like going to a movie.
And it's not like you're struggling to hear it either. It's loud and clear. There's no mistake in it. Like you're not going, gee, am I hearing voices? No. It's
you know
you're
that.
Killing your planet. Yes. And without going into
does
a lot
it
of detail,
get to the end.
Well, after that,
Does it show the dead planet?
It just shows everything from what it was and what it is, and I think what it can be or will be, because some of the bad scenes, which it did the reverse to your system. Now remember, you're hooked up, so there's something
right.
They're pumping something into your bloodstream that's going into your to release the chemicals in your brain to get an extra sense out of this, be it good or be it bad. And so when it came to the ugly stuff, you're just like. You're just not yourself. You're falling apart. You're going, oh, my God, it's awful. And that's what all these people are doing. Mm-hmm. They take the memory of the lesson away, but the emotions and the trauma of the good and the dark part of the thing are retained within the individuals after they come back. So they're not remembering, gee, I was sleeping, and then I was laying in this pile, and then the ship came and beamed me up. And then I was put in front of this monitor. They're not remembering that, but they're remembering the essence of the message.
Right, right.
So it's an emotionally powerful thing, and it's intellectually powerful. So they come away. That's why it doesn't surprise me when I hear all these deputies saying, well, yes, we're saying that I feel like I'm on a mission to... for the Earth's survival.
But then you had the documentary, and did you see this guy again? I mean, did you walk down the street and say, hi, I saw you, you're supposed to do a documentary. Is that how that works?
No, I let it flower. See, and I had to really bite my tongue. But I learned so much patience with all of this, and I'm not perfect by a long shot. I'm not even close. But when I saw, I was at a conference several months later, you know, and I didn't document the exact times. It could have been 6 months, 8 months later after that particular abduction, a few months, 3 months, I can't remember. I used to memorize all of that, but once I got to a point where I just didn't. But anyway, it was definitely after the experience. And I was standing outside on the sidewalk outside a conference, and it was in Tampa, as I recall. And here comes this guy. With this, you guys are pros with the media. He had one of these giant cameras on him, on his shoulder.
Yes, right.
So he was on he was being contracted out. He had a video production company to film something with this conference. He didn't have interest in UFOs. He didn't have any interest in aliens. He didn't have any interest in the environmental thing. But I saw this guy walking by, and I went, oh, my God, it's him.
Yeah.
It's that guy, because he was in my face. It just took my breath away, but I bit my tongue. I didn't even say hello. I didn't say nothing. He walked right by, but what was funny...
Well, you had that wife experience earlier.
I was going to stop him if he didn't stop, you know, but I was letting it go, and as he kept going, then he stopped short. And the cat, you know, his body just wobbled with the weight of this camera, and he turned around, this whole thing turned around, and he walked up to me, and we started conversation. And he told me he was there to film... film a certain aspect of whatever that was at the conference. And I knew it was this guy, and I want to say, man, don't you know who I am? I know who you are. But I kept my mouth shut. To not make the story too long, he started talking to me, and he says, why are you here? And I said that I've had some experiences, and a lot of it has to do with the ET thing. I didn't go into any detail with him. I said that... I'm a little different. I wasn't even speaking, I don't think, then. I think I was there because some people said, you should go to this alien thing because of who you are, and whatever the case was at the time. I might have been speaking at that time. I can't remember. But he started asking me questions about the phenomena, and he started automatically getting into it. And I could see the expression on his face from, I don't care, to... this is me.
Right, yeah. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, let's follow up on that.
Okay.
And one thing I'm interested in is basically we always talk about what the aliens look like, the ETs, the extraterrestrials. I want to know what the people that were abducted look like. You're a slim-looking guy in good shape. Everybody in good shape?
No, I see all sorts, all sizes. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippen. No, go away. We're at the UFO Congress.
In March of 1997, a huge triangular ship appeared over Phoenix. Thousands saw it, and even now, years later, Phoenix is a place of UFO intrigue, sightings, experiences.
It just didn't look like anything I'd ever seen in my life.
Hear about it on The Jerry Pippen Show.
This is Jerry Pippen, and we have Paula Harris with us, and, of course, Jim Sparks has held us on the edge of our chair here with all of this. How come you remember all this? Other people don't.
Well, in the early years, I didn't take kindly to any of it, and I've always been honest. I've always had, to the best of my ability, I've had a logical and straightforward thinking, and called a teapot, called the kettle black if it's black, whatever it might be.
I understand. You make a good reporter. What did you do for a living?
What did you do for a living?
At the time, I was buying raw land in North Carolina and divided it into home sites.
Right.
Yeah, right. But my deal was, and something about me that was always a part of me, was that I was environmentally concerned without even knowing I was environmentally concerned.
I understand.
When it came to the trees on the property, I had in the deed, because you can do it in Carolina at the time, that even after they bought the property from me, that you couldn't cut down the trees except for so many feet from where you're going to build your home. The rest of it had to stay wooded, and I sold half-acre to two-acre lots. So my rule was the trees always had to remain.
So you're giving this environmental message now. Maybe you were selected specifically because you leaned toward that already.
Sorting adding up that way, it seems.
It certainly does. Now, I got to find out what Paula asked you. We got to know the answer here. How did you guys get to making the documentary?
Well, he automatically started, just his facial expressions changed when I started talking about a little bit about my experiences and about the fact that it was related to the rainforest. And he says, you know, he says, I really, because I can remember him saying these things, I don't really have an interest in this subject, but I think it would be important to make, he says, would you be interested in maybe sharing your story and the thing about the environment, and maybe we should put something together? And that's how this thing started.
Uh-huh.
So he lived in Tampa at the time, and he still may live, he still lives in Tampa, or the Tampa area. And I lived at the time on the southwest coast of Florida.
Are you still in Florida?
No,
or
I
live in
Vegas?
Las Vegas.
Okay. This was like, I think this was like 10 years ago, actually, yeah. And so we kept contact, and then I went into more detail with my story, and I had a manuscript going at the time, so I sent him the manuscript. He just was enthralled, overwhelmed. with this thing.
You hadn't told him?
No.
Okay.
And it was hard. And I did not want to say. And I just wanted to see, because this, I try to be as scientific as I can without being a scientist.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want to encourage it. I didn't want to discourage it. I encouraged where it should be, but I didn't want to say, hey, man, you're this guy.
Yeah,
well,
right.
He knows now because things started coming to him. And that's
okay,
what
that's what I was getting at. Okay.
So anyway, as this thing developed and we started making this thing, I had gone to his house, and he was with his girlfriend, and this was just one thing that was leading to his memory coming back, and he had an abduction while I was over there. And after the abduction, then he started remembering bits and pieces of this mass abduction. What he says, you know, these things are coming to me. And I never said anything to him, like, there was a mass abduction, and there was this, and there was this, and there was that. And then it got to the point where he was just repeating everything that had taken place almost, which was, he remembers being somewhere, he remembers the monitors, he remembers the earth scenes. And as the time went on, I said, okay, Doug, let me tell you who you are.
Yeah.
Now, here's how I told him who he was. Mm-hmm. I had a sketch artist sketch this guy long before I met him, because of that scene of the clearing of the woods and everything. I wanted the best memory of that encapsulated.
Yeah, right.
His clothes and everything.
Right. And so she went. This the one thing about the sketch artist. She was Galante is her name. She was very good about capturing the detail of the faces and the people and the things I experienced in the abduction scenarios over the years, and it's in the book.
Yes.
And I'm not pushing the book. I'm just saying
they can find it.
Okay. Yeah. And so I described that gentleman to my right, and she got the clothes, and she got the face, and she got the hair, she got the physique, she got all of that, and that's him. And so when I showed him the sketch,
so
he came
reaction?
To life. All the pieces started to come together,
yeah, right.
So he got excited about it. So Doug Radonte is his name. The name of the company at the time was Infinite Communications. I don't know if he still owns it, but I'll tell you what this guy went further to do. He went through some hard financial times, like we all do, up and down. He was doing well, went through some bad times. Now he's back up again, and he's got personal aircraft now. Remember when that tsunami came through?
Yeah.
He got with a guy in Germany that this environment and helping people is just all ingrained in him. Wonderful person, and he's doing this on a global basis. When that tsunami came through, he got together with this German fella who invented this water purifier. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's about the size of a briefcase. You can put it in a cesspool. It doesn't have to have power. It works on, literally, and pure water will come out. It does like 30 gallons an hour.
Wow.
And it's not like some secret thing. It's out. It's like $2,000 or $3,000 for a piece for this thing. So he invested his money with this guy to get it out to those people that were stricken over there, especially the workers that were working and drinking water that had cholera in it.
Right, right.
Because people would come, young men and women were coming down by the thousands from India, where it wasn't trouble, to help, to uncover the dead people and the sick people. They were volunteering, and they were literally going in that water with their hands and drinking it as they were helping these people and dying from disease. Doug couldn't stand the idea of that. So himself and this German man with their money and his planes and all that stuff flew these water purifiers over there. So he still gets involved in this stuff, you know, quite heavily. So from seeing someone on board under that scenario and seeing how it flowered and seeing how his heart was into that documentary, because he made that. Now, he's always said it's not good enough for sale. He says, I don't want it for sale. It's for educational purposes. It's not the quality in his mind that we should sell it. And so we tried to move it a little bit here and there for educational purposes, but it's not for sale. It's not a commercial enterprise. It's just to, you know, educate the public.
Do you think the keepers are proud of you guys for being interested in the environment and doing things like this now? Is this part of the object, the reason you guys were grabbed?
There's more to it, and see, I'm tight-lipped about things for a reason.
I'll
share something with you.
Okay.
Yeah, of course I will. Okay. But I'm tight-lipped about certain things for different reasons. What I've learned is when things are out of sync and I talk ahead of time, it does more to mess it up than it does to help the situation.
Okay.
So, yeah, the answer as far as pride, that's an emotion. When you talk about grays, I don't think there's pride. There's no ego there. When you talk about the reptilian beings who get the bad rap for everything, for whatever reason, in my experience, mm-hmm. no, they're the good guys. There are some emotions there. So, yes,
so
it would be a
sense. So you're saying the reptilian are good guys. In other words, they have emotions and they are people. They're more people-oriented.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, caring.
Caring.
They talk to you. They feel. And they're extremely intelligent like the Greys are. They have the technology like they do. Now, there may be species that are just rotten, terrible people, because I've heard about women being raped and all these other awful stories regarding that. But I think there's different groups and different races. And the ones.
And again, they never
you
told
know.
You, they don't have a name for themselves. We're calling them reptilian. But they, I'm sure they don't call themselves reptilian. They don't have a name for themselves.
You know, and the silliest thing with me is that I'm so non-selfish when it comes to being around these guys, because I don't ask questions like,
what do I call you?
You or this and that. But I ask them to do simple little things that mean something to me, like, before we part, can you wave? Now, here I have creatures from other dimensions on the other side of the galaxy with all this technology and all of this knowledge, and I ask them something stupid like, oh, when you go, can you wave? Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just want to see something that
verifies.
Have you built up any relationships with anyone? Is it possible?
Well, when I say personal. Tight-lipped about some things, I'm not trying to be facetious.
Sure.
Or keep,
okay.
I'm in a
okay,
sensitive
they're
now
right.
We because
don't
I want
it
to continue.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
this is what I do, and you can be assured of this. An interaction will take place that I know I shouldn't talk about yet. I let several months go by, and then I share it. For two reasons. One is the trail is now cold because there are people who would like to follow you and track you and everything or whatever. The trail is cold. And secondly, I get the full picture or a more complete picture because as each interaction takes place, it creates a picture and an answer. And then when I go into talking about it, now I've got the beginning, I've got the middle, and I've got the end, if I'm making sense. So yes, there's interaction. Yes, it's evolved. Yes, it's in a much better way. And I know certain things now. I know for a fact that time travel, it's not just possible, it's done. It's routine. I know that the biggest push is not just the environment, and this is something I'm just getting from them now, which is about our own longevity. The problem we have as a species is we don't live long enough. The human lifespan is too short to be totally positive. In other words, about the time good people start to figure it out, unfortunately, we die.
Right.
So it puts us in a position to constantly make the same mistakes over and over and over and over and repeats itself and repeats itself. And you even know by our children when you're teaching children and you're teaching them your life's experiences, they're going to either take a third of what you said or two-thirds of what you said and trash it. And they still got to go through it themselves.
So they're changing this thing about the life expectancy?
They want to see us. This is what they know we can do. And this is
we
kind
can
of
do
the,
it.
Yes, this is the latest with me myself.
In other words, it's kind of like the Army slogan, be the best you can be, and then we're not there yet.
But we will. Meaning that you won't stop dying is a message. Meaning that we can extend
So we can
our
control
life.
Our own longevity?
Because we learn, yes. The resources are here. The technology is here. The money is here. It couldn't be a better place, a better time than now to change this. And all the resources are here for, because quite frankly, if you live, let's say you're a very good person,
mm-hmm.
and you lived 500 years longer than you normally would now.
You could do a lot more.
What would you, if
you did.
Well, you
have
did,
a lot of experiences to bypass things.
Would the world not be a better place?
I agree.
Yeah, you'd learn. You'd learn.
And if you had millions and billions of people, you were learning by mistakes and literally retaining it and learning it and not making the same mistakes.
You'd graduate to another level.
The bumper music's going. Fox got us. The name of the book is The Keepers. Jim Sparks is the author. Incredible, Jim. We're going to have you back someday.
I'd love to.
And it's just an unbelievable story. Paula, you have a final statement or question?
I just want to thank Jim for sharing with us, because when he does it for all humanity. And it's a real gift. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim Sparks.
Thank you.
And finally, on this show about abductions, ET abductions, we are going to feature Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, in a broadcast we did back in 2001. here in Muskogee, Oklahoma, at my hometown radio station when they were streaming. And we were on nationally with a syndicated show. And Daryl, in this interview, talks about how he became an alien hunter, how he was abducted. And we pick up the conversation with Daryl explaining to me why ETs smell bad.
And how they smell.
Feeling like very much like soft clay because it's kind of moist.
When you say soft clay like that, it's pliable, huh?
At least to the touch, I mean,
it's like touching your hand. You push it in.
That is true. And yeah. The interesting thing is what they smell like. Now, this is where you catch a lot of people. A lot of these people, and I had, in fact, a lady two nights ago that called, and her and her daughter, she said, "Mr. Sims, I don't even know how to describe this. I don't even know what's going on, and I really don't want to know. But we've got this terrible smell on our hands after these strange dreams that my little girl and I both had last night." And I said, "Well, what did the smell smell like?" And she says, "Sulfur." And, of course, that's one of several answers that are all very consistent and very close together. And, of course, she asked the question. She says, "What is the sulfur from?" I said, "I don't have any idea." I said, "I can guess." I said, "Maybe that's where they come from. I don't know."
It may be part of a chemical base of their makeup.
You know? It's entirely possible.
At least the odor of it.
Well, they smell like other descriptions are given too: rotten, mildewed leather or moldy cardboard, things that tend to be rotten eggs, things that tend to indicate that they're exuding something on the surface of their skin, or if that's what it is, and that there is no cleanliness involved. In other words, the smell seems to stay there. And if they touch you or you touch them, it gets on you as well. Sometimes you'll find the same smell beside your bed on the floor if they've been there next to you.
So conceivably, you could, for lack of a better description, I guess, tell they're coming by smelling them.
Well, interestingly enough, some people, and this is fairly rare, but some people seem to know or sense when they're coming either that day or even hours before, and they start getting real scared.
I'm going to pay you account to that.
Unless it was some type of, my thinking is the way they even find you is through possibly a neural scan. Perhaps this is, at least it's a metaphor of how they find us. They know exactly who we are and where we are, and only on the very rarest of occasions actually lose us. And they did my senior investigator for 22 years. But generally speaking, if they, let's say they are scanning you with something that could pick up your neural pathways and they identified you, some people might be sensory acute to that and actually notice that somebody's watching or sensing them in some way.
All right, I see what you're saying. Now, you, of course, had that first experience when, what, were you four or five, something like that?
I was three and a half. I use the term four, but three and a half is what
actually. So you're after these guys with a mission.
You can just bet on it.
And I'm amazed, and you kind of glossed it over when I kind of half-kiddingly asked you last week, aren't you afraid they're going to seek you out again now that you might be getting close?
Well, I honestly don't have any concerns about that because I think my last event when I was age 17, my events went on from age 4 to for 13 years till 1967, from 1952 to 1967, and at the end of those, the last event was so traumatic and horrific that I was actually working with a psychologist at the time at my high school, and we were studying scientific anomalies, which is a real hobby I had, and he was very fascinated with it. He was working with me, and long story short is after my event that night, I went to my girlfriend the next day, told her, because it started getting dark about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I started getting scared. I mean, I thought they were coming back. I told her the story, and this is the lady I was supposed to marry, and she looked at me like a calf looking at a new gate. And, of course, you got to understand, back then there were no aliens, there were no stories. Betty and Barney Hill was the closest thing to anything, and back in 66?
Yeah.
So here I am telling them the story, and she just said, "Well, you've had this terrible, terrible dream." And then so she took me to him because I would not be consoled. And he told me the same thing. Well, when they land, they're going to land on the White House lawn and give the president a new gift or something. I said, "Hey, I saw the movie. It doesn't work like that." And he said, "Well, this must have been a dream. You've had a terrible, terrible dream." I said, "Well, whatever my dream was broke the lock on my door coming in." The lock is broken from the inside to the room. The door doesn't open outward. And no one in my house woke up over the event. And I just went on and everything. He just sat there white as a sheet. He just didn't know what to say. Of course, back then, like I said, nobody knew what to do. Nobody knew what you're, even if you're telling the truth. Now a lot of people are coming forward telling the same exact story since I did in 1952.
Wow. We have our first phone caller here tonight, Daryl. Last week we didn't take any phone calls because we were so entranced and enthralled with your story, I forgot to answer the phones.
Sure.
But Ed is listening on KBIX in Muskogee, Oklahoma. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I got a question. Back about 1978, or it was about 75, I think, I was found asleep, and I had woke up, and my family was not in the house, okay? So anyways, I went out the front door of our house, and on the corner was a group of people standing there, and they were looking up, and what it was a disc-shaped object with lights, multicolored lights on it, and I remember that vaguely. I mean, I was a child then, but everybody thinks I'm crazy when I say that.
Yeah, now, Ed, hold on. Daryl, could you hear him?
Yes, I could.
Yeah, okay. Daryl, say hello to Ed.
Hello, Ed. How you doing?
Pretty good. You all right?
Very good, sir.
I guess what Ed really wants to know, Daryl, is how old were you when you... I guess he wants to know if he might have had some kind of experience he doesn't know about. I mean, like, did you ever see a flying saucer, Daryl?
I'll answer that two ways. My answer, your question is yes, I've seen over 50 in my lifetime. The second question is that many abductees actually do not, quote-unquote, see or pay attention to the craft that they're taken by. The only thing they remember is being in the room or being somewhere else and then something happening.
Ed, were you in Muskogee when you saw this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well.
My daddy was born in Muskogee.
Yes, sir.
Good place.
Okay.
Great people live there.
Ed, we probably haven't answered it very much for you, but, you know, there have been sightings around Muskogee. I have one guy, Daryl and Ed, when I was doing a network show on the Independent Broadcasters Network about 94, 95. I was over the studio across the hall here. We were doing a UFO show, and I said one night, anybody, you know, I never have heard anything from our listeners at KHJ, which was the station was carrying us at the time here in Muskogee. I never have heard anybody from Muskogee tell me about seeing a flying saucer, and a guy called up and said he saw one about the size of a football field over south of town around Davis Field. You know, and since then, there have been big reports of that, floating blimp-type objects. So,
yes. Yes. Did you have a question, sir?
Well, I got one more thing to tell you. And I also remember, at the south of town, this was in the middle of the day, I must have been 11 or 12 years old, the sky was very orange, okay? And there was an object in the air, and we had called the Muskogee Police Department, and they explained it as being a weather balloon, but it didn't move like a weather balloon. This thing moved back and forth.
Well, I've got some wonderful film footage of an object moving against the wind, and it looks like a gigantic rope, probably hundreds of feet long, in a twining figure eight form, just floating through the air going in different direction. And I can't explain that, and I don't know any police officer could either.
Okay, thanks, Ed.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, yes, bye-bye.
Sir. Bye.
You know, I think he brings up an interesting point. I want to ask you something about this, Daryl, and that is the fact of these abductions. You mentioned last week, and I got several responses by email about the fact that what was a 45% American Indian and Irish of your people that you think that are abductees?
45% that we've worked with out of over 1,000 cases worldwide, 45% of the people we've worked with are Native American Indian.
Now, the point he's bringing up is there's two sightings he made here in this little town of Muskogee. I guess it just runs the gambit of where these people are abducted from, huh?
Well, there's. I'll give some other stats for your audience if they have an interest. 31% of the people that we have worked with worldwide, and I mean this is France and everywhere else, have reported a rare drug allergy to Novocaine, Lidocaine, Xylocaine, any of the cane family, cocaine, of course nobody can admit that, but the cane family itself is a rare drug allergy, and up to 31% of these people, based on our stats, have this rare drug allergy.
Well, you know, I immediately think, Daryl, about the smelling like sulfur, and now this statistic, I mean, there's an answer there someplace. We just don't know it, right?
65% of our people report cravings for salt during their, especially after their events. And it's interesting, in a support group, you can put good, healthy food on one side, you know, vegetables and all kinds of neat stuff. And we purposely put salt, like potato chips and all kinds of salt foods on the other side, and watch everybody gravitate like cattle to the salt lick. It's really funny to watch.
I still crave salt even months after the abduction?
That is correct. In fact, a movie producer out in Hollywood took me to dinner after a shoot we did for 2 days, and he and his team were sitting there, and they bought me this huge medium-rare steak, and they did, I noticed they were watching me. I couldn't figure out, well, what in the world are they watching? So I took the lid off my salt, and I just coated the top and the bottom of this thing and poured about half of the rest of it in this little container for the sauce, and they just were shocked. He said, you mean all this stuff you've been telling us is true? I said, absolutely.
So you still crave salt?
Absolutely. Yes, yes.
See, I, on a personal basis, I thought maybe I had had an abduction experience, but I don't really crave salt.
Well,
I just remember a strange man by the side of my bed when I was very young.
Yes.
A strange figure, a humanoid figure.
Yes.
Which is probably just a dream on my part.
It could be. That does happen. 63% of the people that we work with report night blindness to some degree. 72% report phobias, often that are not even natural. 30% reported the smell of the sulfur on them or in their home or in their events. 88% have unexplained burns, bruises, marks, cuts, lumps, scars, long finger bruises, anomalous markings, scooped out places, or even strap marks where they've been held down in their event.
You know, I can understand the phobias part, because some of these people, and, you know, I've heard terrible stories, and then some people think it's a happy experience, and you and I kind of visited about that last week where you said it's kind of in the eyes of the beholder.
Well, the entities do something rather remarkable. They have two things that they do to you. And the easiest way probably for your audience to understand this from my point of view is think of them as a genetic engineer, which I don't think they are, but we'll use this as a model. They're a genetic engineer, and they have two different kinds of lab rats. One of them are lab rat pets that they like, and they can pat and then give them a big shot or whatever, and, of course, traumatize them with a shot or whatever it is they're doing to them. And then they put them back down, and then they tell the little lab rat pet that you won't remember, and they usually don't. In fact, they'll give them a what is referred to as a screen memory, which is from Freudian psychology, and it basically means it's something in place of a real memory they don't want to remember. It's a traumatization. The second group are people those are called contactees. The abductees are people who are the same lab rats, but they do remember, and they won't forget. And they don't have the same experience. They will not accept the screensaver memories in many cases.
In other words, it's not the pleasant. You feel they remember the real thing.
Well, in fact, these type lab rats will bite you if they remember anything, and so they tend to get a little more punished for it.
We are talking with I like to call you the alien hunter, and in fact I think you get some kind of movie deal working in that direction, and we don't want to talk about it too much and jinx anything, Daryl, but you've had quite a life. Before I get into some of these past things, I want to get back to the implants a little bit with you. Before we get to that, what's the latest in your life? Kind of, is there anything you can share with us that you're working on right now?
Oh yes. I'm wanting to do my own TV shoot, first of all, because I'm tired of giving all these people this great stuff on TV and then making a fortune off of it, and then our work just literally barely makes it on what little they give us for the research. So one of the things I've discovered and I want to work on is a rather large object that we found underground in a foreign country, and some of the scientists that are working with me think it's a UFO. I don't think it is, and I've told them that, and one of them is absolutely insistent that it is a UFO, because it's shaped just like a UFO, and it's about that size, and it's about 10 feet underground.
So you haven't dug it up yet?
It's a big one. So I have a little tiny sample, and I've done some study on it, and I want to produce that. I want to do a show that shows a fake UFO, in this case, a misrepresented object that could easily be a UFO in most people's eyes, but isn't. And then I eventually, the third thing I want to do in the show is actually show a case where we're actually involved in looking for in a real story of a UFO, in which there, in fact, may be evidence.
Well, that'd be an interesting project. I think there's enough interest out there. I surely you'll get that off the ground here pretty soon. I hope so. I want to ask you about, a little bit about these implants. We didn't get into a whole lot of details about that, but you generally are accepted to be either the first one to figure out that there might be implants in some of these abductees, or one of the first. And Roger Lear gets a lot of that credit, and I guess you worked with him at one time, right?
Well, actually, he worked for me on our project. Uh-huh. I was had a number of surgeries done before our first public surgeries in 19, and at that point, I'd asked Dr. Lear, who is a foot doctor, to surgery.
I couldn't remember whether he was a podiatrist or a dentist.
Yes, but that's correct. And we had to get an MD to do the other surgeries. In fact, an MD's done all the other surgeries simply because he is not able to do those type of surgeries. He's not qualified to do that medically. But now we have a cardiovascular surgeon, this is a kind of an unpleasant little aspect, but one of the reasons I had to let Roger go is because some of our evidence started disappearing, and the abductees were screaming about it. In fact, they still are. And since it was in his care at the time, that and some other problems,
I understand. I'm not trying to dig up any dirt or dishes.
No, not at all. So we had to let him go. We have a cardiovascular surgeon now that handles all our cases and very well qualified. In fact, is up for admiral.
But Lear, you know, has a lot of people who say bearing things across the spectrum about him. And I understand when you first met him and brought up the subject, he was kind of a skeptic.
He did not believe in any of this, and of course, I've been through this for about 10 years with over the whole spectrum. I kind of see a little more of the whole picture, and especially from some private talks that we had. But basically, I think he saw the unusualness of it after. I made two medical predictions that were impossible before the surgeries. I said, if these, in fact, are real alien implants, or this phenomena, we're going to find no signs of inflammatory response, either chronic or acute.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing we're going to find is that these objects have the wrong nerve cells present around them. And after that, he called me that afternoon with the other doctor, and they were literally freaked out, and they wanted to know, how in the world could you predict something that would be medically impossible? And I said, I guess you'd had to been there. I said, in 1960, was on the other end of that business and had something rammed up my left nostril in my own experience. That's how I discovered implants, and that's why I knew so much about them.
Did you remove that implant?
The object, we never found it afterward. Sometimes they will come back apparently and remove these objects themselves from time to time. We have a number of cases where this is, in fact, we even have x-rays. I've got one of x-ray of an object that looks like and is the size of a lifesaver deep in the person's skull. This is a case in Brazil. And a few months later, the object is gone. And, I mean, the object is solid. It is radio opaque. You can even see ridges on it. I mean, it's just an amazing case.
Well, did the subject remember being abducted another time?
They remember the abductions, but they don't remember how the object got out.
Yeah, I just wondered if
Unfortunately, I've not worked with the individual personally, so once I can get to them, I think I can get a lot more information.
I wanted to ask you about this other organization that you've been associated with or at least worked with. I don't know a lot about them. Parsec?
Parsec, yes.
Yeah, that's psychotherapists associated for the research and the study.
Well, it's the Parsec is an organization that invited me to join their organization. They're all MDs. Several of them have PhDs and MDs. They're a remarkably sharp bunch.
Are they in Europe someplace?
They are in Italy. Uh-huh. In fact, I will be going to Florence and doing a presentation there in mid-May. And then when I finish there, I will go to a scientist's home and stay there for 3 days, and we'll work on an implant detector by is one of the things he's going to develop for me, as well as several other things that I have on my little
shop. Did you say an implant tester?
An alleged implant detector. It'll be a device that will look at a number of signatures at one time, so I can scan a human being and see if we can get some type of signature from the alleged object that may be putting out a signature.
A signature, like what?
Well, it could be a signature that might be
You're looking for something abnormal.
Anything that would not be natural coming from a human being.
Okay. I just want to get clear in my head. Now you don't have a medical background, do you?
The only background I have in the medical field is strictly through my hypnotic anesthesia training. And my medical certifications in medical hypnotherapy. Other than that, my only involvement in that is whenever I go into the OR and work and do hypnotic anesthesia on patients, or whether I work with.
So you've actually done that.
So that is true. Yes, in fact, in the movie, the TV program Confirmation that was on TV, I was the one doing hypnotic anesthesia on the patient there.
And that's pretty interesting in itself. That's a whole new story right there. You just mentioned that. It popped in my mind, this alien autopsy thing that came up, several years ago, and I guess it turned out to be a fake, right?
That is correct.
And were you involved in that in any way?
Well, yes and no. I wasn't involved in the initial exploration and the initial showing of the film, that sort of thing. But I did go to England four times in 3 months, and I met with Ray Santilli, the one who owned the film, who bought it. And I sat down with him and finally convinced him to release a small segment of the film to me, in which he did. I came back to England, and a courier, in fact, it was Philip Mantle, delivered the film to me personally at a meeting after a TV show. And I reviewed the film and had a university in Canada to look at the film. These people are not UFO related and very tough, and that's what I wanted. And we were able to determine that film that I had, that he gave me, the claim was part of that film, was in fact not even the age that he was claiming it.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew that was fraud. I thought it was fraud simply because of the fact that I'd already spoken to him, and I'm extremely good at determining whether people are lying or telling the truth when I question them over a period of time.
Well, I better watch it.
So I thought I had him anyway, and whenever he gave up that piece of film, that was it. I mean, that was the coffin, nail in the coffin for me.
Right. So the only reason I mentioned some of these things is to get clarifications on it, and also to let our audience know that one of the things I found out about Daryl Sims, folks, is that kind of just report it wherever the ball lands. In other words, if it turns out to be a hoax, you're ready to admit it, right?
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately, as I said before, some of the revelations from another book, and I won't mention it, about implants, said that there were crystalline implants and all kinds of things we found. That's just not true. What the professor asked me from the university was, what do you think this one is? And I said, I think it's a shard of glass from a mason jar, personally, because it was found in the person's foot, and it looks like that. Mm-hmm. And he analyzed it and said one of his scientists broke a mason jar in a million pieces and found one just exactly like it with the same exact consistency, chemically and everything else. So, unfortunately, that was not reported, even though we had the report in hand. The report came out, it was a crystalline implant. Well, that's just not true.
Well, these implants are wrapped in some sort of cocoon thing, if I remember correctly.
That is true. Some of the objects, the first public surgery, and you got to understand, in 1988, I was doing this and having surgeries done independently. I didn't want any of them public, simply because I wanted to make sure I had a case before I brought the first two cases publicly. The first two cases were brought publicly in 1995, and the two surgeons were there, a foot surgeon and a general surgeon was working on the patient, one hand and one in the foot. All the objects had a biological cocoon. So the best way to think of this for your audience is imagine, if you will, a rare meteorite in a perfect T formation, a capital T formation, wrapped in human skin from the surface of the, like the scoop mark area that people report having as an abductee, wrapping that that perfect T-shaped rare meteorite material in that cocoon, and then nerve proprioceptors and nerve tissue spreading out from that and attaching itself to a main nerve supply in the body, and being there for 30 years and you not knowing it even was there, and there's no scar, no sign of how it got there. And that is the way it goes down.
Talking with Daryl Sims, and let's go into the websites here, Daryl. We have links to them, of course, on our webpage at jerrypippin.com. But let's go ahead and get those addresses again for people, because, you know, this is the best way for them to get a hold of you, right?
Yes, sir. The best way for them to get a hold of me is to simply go to our, if you're an abductee or contactee or feel like you've had experiences or something along that line that was anomalous, what you might want to do is just type in alienhunter.org. And you can look over the site that's primarily designed for people of our ilk, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then go down to the bottom and click on Alien Hunter, and that'll give you my email address automatically. Or if you're more scientifically minded and want to think of things in a different realm, more of a medical point of view, you can go to my other site, which is called firstevidence.org. This one has more of a scientific medical viewpoint. And the sites are under construction, and we recently lost our webmaster, so we're looking for another one. There's a wonderful volunteer out there that wants to learn some things that other folks simply don't know. This is the time to give me an email.
Well, good. Maybe you'll get a volunteer here off of our show.
Well, Jerry, all of our work is philanthropic. We don't charge anything for anything we do for abductees. All our work is all the surgeries we've done. We've paid for out of our own pocket, or have our doctors have volunteered. The hotels these people stay in, the airline flights and everything, I pay for personally. So this is not a money-making deal. The only thing we have for sale at all are 5 videos that are available, and that's all, and those are all professionally done. But that's it. Everything is philanthropic. And
you mentioned firstevidence.org. Is that going to be the name of your book?
Well, my book is changed now since we have this individual looking at us from a movie point of view. I've decided to go ahead with the name of my second book and go ahead and open the second book up first, which is called Alien Hunter, and based on the hopefully what the movie will be.
Good. We wish you a lot of luck on that. We still have a few minutes here, about 5 or 6, 7 more minutes with you, and we're going to get you back fairly often. When I told you that last week, I never dreamed it'd be that much, but we got a lot of people wanted you back.
Well, there are a lot of wonderful people out there that have had experiences, and there's nothing wrong with these people. They've seen something, heard something, or felt something that other people didn't feel, know, or see. That doesn't make them crazy. It just means they had an experience you didn't or somebody else didn't have. That's all.
I'm going to ask you, is there any way the intelligence community, I mean, is there any way these things can be black projects, or are you pretty certain it's aliens themselves?
Well, I'm convinced that it's both. In fact, I have a whole presentation. For those of you that have interest, you have a UFO group out there, you need a presenter, I have a whole presentation just on the government involvement and the alien agenda. My presentation I made in Slovakia, of all places, twice. I spoke to the former intelligence people there. I was the first American ex-CIA to actually speak to these people. And they were all exposing what they knew about their intelligence communities and their countries and from these former Russian satellites. And I keynoted the event, and I said, how long do I have? And they said, how long do you want to speak? And I said, how long do I have? And they said, how long do you want to speak? So I spoke for 4 hours. They were, I hope, my impression was that they were pretty much riveted to the chairs, because the amazing thing were the Russians that were sitting there, Russian scientists verifying everything I said. They already knew what I was telling. That was what was beautiful about it. They had already proven this stuff themselves. So I think the intelligence community they've got their hand in this too. And I'll give the thumbnail and the whole overall picture of this. For the most part, there's a group, a rogue element inside of the National Security Agency that's in charge of this sort of thing. Everybody in the CIA and everywhere else does not know about aliens and all of this sort of thing. If you ask them that, they'll think you're nuts, and they'll really mean it, because they don't know what you're talking about. But there are groups that do know this, and they know infinitely more than most of the UFO community. The unfortunate thing, in times past, the UFO communities have been infiltrated by the intelligence community. This is a known fact in times past. It's easily provable, and they admitted it. The fact is that the intelligence community is absolutely, in my opinion, afraid. And when I say the intelligence, I mean not the whole community. I mean the ones that do know, that are witting. And those of you who are in the intelligence community, you know what I'm talking about. Those of you who are witting to this know exactly that you cannot control the alien presence. You never will. You never have been able to. And you can deny that all you want to. But the fact is, they're still out there and still doing what they want, and you can't stop them. The closest thing you've ever done to that is to develop the DSP satellite system of 18 satellites, 23,300 miles up, the ones that are very famous for the in the movie Enemy of the State.
Sure.
That system uses three different eyes to see with: infrared, ultraviolet, and the visible light spectrum. And these same, as one friend of mine who helped design some of this stuff, said it's a $125 million UFO detector. And that's exactly what it is, because it can see UFOs when they wink out and they're like invisible. They're often still there, and they can see them in the infrared or ultraviolet range.
So you're saying that these UFO reports that we do every week about, you know, just normal citizens, and it's pretty common that they're there, and all of a sudden, bang, they're like gone into warp speed or something, disappeared. You say they're cloaking themselves or something.
That is the report to me from the DSP satellite specialist.
Uh-huh.
In fact, he told me, he says, I want to ask you a question. Where did you ever get the idea to start looking on abductees with infrared, ultraviolet? And he said, I know you do visible inspections on these people. How did you do that? And I said, it seemed the correct way to me. He said, well, that's brilliant. He said, because that's the same thing we have been using on our $125 million UFO detector up there.
So you're saying you didn't pick that up in the intelligence community? Or
not at all.
It just came to you?
Not at all. It's just
a deduction you decided to try.
There's a lot of things I've done like that that'll show up in my book. My book, I hope, will be a handbook for people to literally go out and do all this stuff by themselves. They won't need me or anybody.
Is it dangerous? I know you're after these guys. Are they? Could they possibly be after you if you show up someplace where they are?
Well, that's the hope. This one lady who gave me the name Alien Hunter, which I later trademarked and everything, she looked at me for a long time, and she's a contactee, by the way. I mean, pretty much likes these guys and so on. And my response to her, she says, my gosh, she said, you're really hunting them. And I said, young lady, I said, I hunt them that hunted me and hunted my son and are probably going to hunt your children. And I said, if it's okay with you to ignore it and act like it didn't happen or hope that it won't happen again, that's fine. That's your mentality, and I have no problem with that. I said, I'm the type of person, when something happens to me, I will find out, and I will know, and I will, and to be kind to everybody here, I will use cautious optimism in finding this out. But you make no mistake about it. As I told Bob Bigelow, the billionaire in Las Vegas, I told him, he says, well, what will all this tell you whenever we get this stuff studied for you and when we pay for all this, and they did, and they were very generous in doing so. I said, it won't tell me, it won't prove to me aliens exist. He said, why not? I said, because it was standing next to my bed when I was 4 years old. Well, I don't need any proof that they exist. I said, what it will tell me is when I get the isotopic ratios or the materials analysis off of these objects, I said, then I will know where they've been mining, and therefore where they had been or where they're currently still at. I said, I hunt aliens, sir. And I really don't care what anybody thinks about that. I don't care if you like it. I don't care if you don't like it. I hunt them that hunted me. I said, now the prey has simply become the predator.
Okay, are you closer?
More than you can imagine.
Well, I'm not going to press you yet.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have any success, you of all people will have to be one of the first people to know. But I really enjoy your program.
I hope I can hold you to that.
I hope that you do.
Yeah. Okay, now. Let's run over your websites again so people can get a hold of you.
That's www.alienhunter.org or www.firstevidence.org. Either one will take you to the other. And please email me. I answer all my emails.
That was Daryl Sims, and that was recorded a little over 10 years ago. And nothing as much has changed. His websites are still the same. Well, actually, Daryl's getting a lot of national recognition. He's on a national cable TV show this week, as a matter of fact. We're almost out of time. Before we go, I want to mention that the new aspie.org website has an announcement that will be coming up in a couple of days, so we're going to scoop them. And that is that the Angel Fire Symposium, the Paranormal Symposium, is moving to Taos, and it'll be there next year. And it won't be in September like it has been the last 2 years. It'll be in October. All those details will be announced later this week. But I gave you a scoop here on the Jerry Pippin Show. So Taos will be our location in October instead of September, and we'll be broadcasting from there as usual. Thanks very much for listening, everyone. I'm Jerry Pippin. Until next time, cheers.